This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Thank you so much. I'm Ross Melnick, professor of film media studies. I'm here with Rebecca Prime, author of Hollywood Exiles in Europe. And Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a treat to, I was just saying to Ross, I actually had never seen this film properly projected on the big screen, so that was really great.
Yeah, well, look great. And one thing that you notice right away is that the title in this print is different from the one we look at. What is Try and Get Me? What's the difference between the title of Sound of the Fury and Try and Get Me?
Yeah, we wanted to assure you actually were in the right screening. So, so Try and Get Me was a title that was sort of tried when the original title, The Sound of Fury, the film wasn't doing well at all. It had received very good reviews, but it wasn't connecting with audiences. So about 2 months into its release, the producer, Robert Stillman, decided that he would repackage it as Try and Get Me to sort of make it more of an action thriller genre film. So he did that in all markets other than in Los Angeles, where he'd already heavily promoted it as The Sound of Fury. So that's the explanation of this more sensational title that he ended up adding to the film.
And what can you tell us about the making of the film? Were there a lot of tensions during the production? What was this whole production like?
So the film came about in, it originated with the 1947 novel called The Condemned by Joe Pagano. And you may have noticed his name in the opening credits because he was also then the writer of the screenplay. And so the film was adapted originally by Pagano working with Robert Stillman, who Robert Stillman was the scion of a grocery heir. His family had a very successful grocery business, and he had decided he wanted to get into making movies and had apprenticed himself to Stanley Kramer, who was an independent producer in the late 1940s, made a number of films you may be familiar with at that time. He had just done Home of the Brave, and Courage was also 1948. But Robert Stillman, who had been associate producer to Stanley Kramer, was getting a bit frustrated, not getting, you know, enough attention. So he had just decided he was going to start his own independent production company. And their first production was The Sound of Fury. Cy Endfield was not the first choice of director for this film. There were a number of other names initially considered, but Cy Endfield was sort of on his way up at that moment. He'd been kicking around Hollywood since the early 1940s. The war sort of came, intervened, put a little bit of a halt to his career. And then when he came back after the war, he was having a hard time breaking in. But finally, in 1950, things were going a bit better for him. He had just made a film called The Underworld Story that had been well received. So he's then attached as director to the film. But immediately, it sort of has quite a different vision for the film than Joe Pagano. And so, you know, Joe Pagano had written the novel. He was very attached to the themes, his vision as he put forth in the novel. And I think what you see on screen here is part of the challenge of adaptation, because you can get away with things in the novel that you can't get away with on screen. So these sort of more pedantic qualities that are really embodied by the Italian professor, that was even more prolific in the novel. Some of the reviews of the novel were, called that out. And Cy Endfield really was not happy with that aspect of the book and did not see eye to eye with Pagano in, you know, keeping that in the screen adaptation. So things got so bad at one point between them that Pagano actually quit and Robert Stillman had to bring him back on. So there was a lot of tension surrounding sort of how to present the whether to present a more philosophical vision, which was where Pagano was coming from, whereas Cy Endfield, who at that time, he was still sort of loosely associated with the Communist Party. He had been joined the party in the early 1940s and was very much part of that radical Hollywood milieu. He really wanted this to be clear that it was social forces that were at the root cause. And he made quite a few changes to the film in sort of placing more emphasis on post-war conditions, the housing shortage, the challenges faced by returning veterans. So there was this tension between the screenwriter and the director in terms of how much emphasis to place on social forces versus sort of a broader philosophical vision.
So you mentioned the post-war moment, and I think that's a good place to talk about the Cold War and the kind of the rise of the political climate around this, and looking at things like poverty, starvation, the flip side of the success of the American dream. When this kind of a nightmare vision of the American dream is presented, what were the kind of realities of the post-war moment for the Cold War, and how did that affect the reception of this film?
Well, it's very interesting. So this film was released early in 1950, I think it was early. And 1950 is one of these pivotal years where things really start to change in the country. And so, you know, America is leading the UN forces in Korea. That by the beginning of the summer, where we are sending troops over to Korea, that's building up. February 1950 is when the senator from Wisconsin delivered his famous speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, about communists in the State Department. So you really have this, throughout the country, this broader feeling of, you know, Cold War paranoia is setting in. More specifically within Hollywood, what happens is that the Hollywood 10 that some people in the audience may be familiar with, these were the original 10 Hollywood directors, screenwriters that were called to testify before the House Committee on Un-American Activities in October 1947. And they had, by that point, exhausted their legal process. The Supreme Court in April 1950 said, sorry, we're not going to hear your appeals. So that was sort of the end of the road for the Hollywood 10. And with that, really sort of allowed Hollywood to, Hollywood felt it had no choice at that point but to fully embrace the blacklist that they had, you know, agreed to in December 1947, that no, they would not hire any known communists, but it was not really fully enforced until 1950, which as a result, you sort of have this really interesting period between 1948 to 1950, where you have quite a few of these independent productions that are really presenting a more dark, very much socially conscious, progressive vision of, as you were just saying, sort of the dark side of the American dream.
And so how soon and how did it come, the backlist, come for Cy Enfield? How did he land on this, and how did it affect his career?
I realized there was something I wanted to say on the last point, so I'm just going to say that, and then I'll get to your next question. But just how this film sort of reflected what was going on in the country is that surprisingly, so, you know, the reviews were good, but it's not really attracting an audience. And Cy Enfield is like wondering, well, what's going on? So there's accounts of him sitting in on screenings in Los Angeles. He's at some theater on the Miracle Mile. And, you know, people are storming out of the screenings saying that this is not the America we know. That they felt the film was profoundly unpatriotic. They felt that, it was sort of fodder for the communists because it could show that Americans were savage and uncivilized and don't uphold the rule of law. So Enfield himself was surprised by the reaction, which in a way was then, you know, reading the tea leaves about what was, you know, coming down the pike for him. So he had a little while longer where he's, you know, trying to continue working in Hollywood. But by the following year, in September of 1951, he was named by an actor called Martin Berkeley, who named like 200 people or some vast, vast number of people. And Enfield, you know, pretty quickly, well, Is it okay if I actually read you something
sure,
from it?
That'd be great.
Because he really deliberated, he deliberated to a surprising degree about what he wanted to do, having been named. So just, you know, at this point, he really felt quite divorced from the Communist Party. He hadn't been active in over 5 years. So he thought he would at least find out what it would entail to clear himself. And so I guess it was, yeah, he asked his agent to explain the procedure for clearing his name, should he want to testify. I'll give you an address in Pasadena, the agent said. It was all very well organized. You meet a couple of people in the FBI office there. You will talk to them and they will ask you all kinds of questions and they will arrange a hearing for you. And if you are going to be a friendly witness, you go there and they take care of you and so forth. But here's Enfield's reaction. And the whole seediness of this action, somehow, of becoming an informer to the FBI, struck me. I just had a sense of personal revulsion. And I can truthfully say that most of the blacklisted people, not all of them, had, in a sense, a political horse to whip. They had a political stake in what they believed or in some past action. And I think the implication there is that he felt that he did it. But nonetheless, just to sort of, as a moral matter, he was repulsed by the idea of naming names. So unlike some of the people who were named in the blacklist, he was fortunate in that he already had a passport. And it was one of these serendipitous things in a sense that his marriage was on the rocks and he was dating an actress and the actress wanted to go away with him somewhere. So he had gotten a passport so that he could potentially take this trip with his new girlfriend. And it turned out then it was a good thing he had this passport and he booked himself passage on the Queen Mary with two suitcases and went to London.
And he essentially restarted his career. But how? What was the viability and challenges of doing that? Of starting all over again in another country?
Absolutely. No, I mean, it was very challenging. So Cy Enfield was one of a small number of American exiles who were in London at the time. Others were Carl Foreman, the screenwriter, Joseph Losey. And then they were sort of part of there were some Canadians as well. They were just part of this broader colony, they called it. But what they found is that it was not too hard to get an agent. They could get an agent quickly because, you know, they were Hollywood directors, Hollywood writers. But actually being able to find work and make movies was much more challenging for a number of reasons. One was, so the British film industry was, you know, vastly smaller than the American film industry and quite centralized. So there were, you know, a few major vertically integrated companies like Rank that had, you know, production distribution and owned theaters. And so that just for one, there were limited options. There really were not, you know, a lot of independent producers to work with. Another issue was the amount of American funding was already not insignificant. It was going to grow to much higher percentages by the 1960s. You had a, you know, very significant amount of Hollywood funding in British films. But even by the mid-1950s, about a third of funds in many UK productions were actually coming from Hollywood. And the problem with that is they needed the US market then to be open to them. And, you know, working with a blacklisted director could very well lead to an American distributor saying, I'm not going to touch this film. Then there were also problems in the UK in that although the trade union for directors, ACT, which I'm forgetting what it stands for, they were generally actually quite communist leaning, they were sympathetic to the exiles. At the same time, they were protectionist, and they, even before the Hollywood exiles had arrived, they were trying to put in place measures to keep out foreign directors. So it was very challenging to get accepted into the trade union. So what many of them did, including Cy Enfield, for I think it was the first five films that Cy Enfield made in the UK, he made with it wasn't just that he had a pseudonym. He had to have somebody who could be on set for him and sort of stand in for him and then whose name would appear in the production. So that the British trade union could say, we are, you know, we're employing Charles de la Tour was one of the pseudonyms, when in fact it was Cy Enfield.
And so one of the probably surprising facts, if those don't know, which is that Cy Enfield eventually actually did name names and returned to the United States. So what was the philosophical, logistical decision to do that? And what do you take from that, 65 years later about this decision? I'm kind of curious about why he did this and what you think his thinking was.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was something that was very curious to me when I was researching my book a long time ago now. And because I don't think, you know, as Patrice said in the introduction, no one had really gone into this sort of depth looking at the history of the directors, actors, writers who went to Europe. So this, in looking into Enfield's record, I found that the National Archives, his testimony is there as part of the records of HUAC's records. And there's always a lot of debate around all these figures who made secret deals. Like in the 1950s, there was tons of speculation. Whenever someone's career was starting to go better, like within this community of exiles, they would all sort of go back and forth, like, oh, do you think he did? Do you think he named names? And in some instances, they didn't. Like, there was a lot of speculation about what Carl Foreman did. And I've seen his testimony, and it's not there in his testimony anyway that he named names. So somehow in 1957, Carl Foreman was able to strike a deal with the House Un-American Activities Committee and clear his name, be able to, you know, work more easily, but without taking that step. So I think that was a factor in Cy Enfield's thinking. He and Carl Foreman were quite close friends. So I think, you know, Cy Enfield wanted things to be easier for him as well and saw that it was possible. But it's very curious because he was at the point that Cy Enfield first approached the committee in 1958. At this point, he's really starting to do better. He's made this film, Hell Drivers, that was for Rank, one of the big British production houses. So it's a bigger budget film, had been, I think, even won a BAFTA. So he's really, like, things are going better. And he doesn't follow proper procedure either. There was a lawyer that all the exiles generally used when they wanted to sort of suss things out in Washington. But Cy Enfield just wrote this handwritten letter. Like, it's very emotional. And what the response that he got in 1958 was that, sorry, you know, we'd love to hear from you, but you gotta name names. So, you know, no dice. So things go quiet for 2 years. And then in 1960, Enfield once again contacts the committee. And this time he's like, he's willing to go whole hog. Again, he's continuing to do better. He's made a number of other films that are, you know, more commercial. So, you know, one speculation is that he was already trying to raise money for the film that probably people know him best for, which is Zulu, which he ended up making in 1964. And so he's having trouble raising money for that. I think that he was also approached by some American, you know, producer who had a nice offer to make him, but the condition was he had to clear his name. But I mean, I'll read you a little bit about how he sort of rationalizes it to himself in his testimony. There was a series of incidents that led me to reverse my position about the using of names of other past associates. I was offered a job by an American producer who subsequently discovered I was on the banned list as far as working in Hollywood was concerned, and the job offer was withdrawn. Rather recently, I was made another offer like this, an attractive job, and my answer was the same. I've not been a communist for many years, but I still had reservations about naming names. That afternoon, I encountered some people I knew who told me of a writer who was blacklisted, Mike Wilson, who was working under the table by arrangement with the producers. And suddenly it occurred to me that as a director in a public function, I was carrying the burden of a moral position far in excess of that carried by individuals who had, by my understanding, much deeper principal feelings about the whole matter. And I realized, why should I turn down the job to do something for and on behalf of individuals who to me were taking an unprincipled position? So some of this seems to be like he's having a bit of sour grapes. Michael Wilson was the screenwriter of, with Carl Foreman, A Bridge on the River Kwai, which had, you know, won Oscar in 1958 or 57, I forget, and then was working at the time with David Lean on Lawrence of Arabia. So I think he's feeling like you know, the writers, Dalton Trumbo, they can get away with this, but I can't because I'm a director. So his Seinfeld's wife, now widow, says, you know, he was very agonized over it. They stayed up all night. But the bottom line is, you know, he did name names. But it's interesting. This is 1960, at which point, you know, as I'm sure many of you are aware, that was also the year that Spartacus came out with Dalton Trumbo's name as the screenwriter. And so sort of the standard history for many years has been, well, at that point, no one really cared about the blacklist anymore. Things are with Spartacus and then Exodus, both of which were very successful despite having been written by Dalton Trumbo. Things become less of an issue. But what I argued in my book is that it's actually like, it was really much more individualized than that. When you were a writer of the caliber of Dalton Trumbo, which is something he sort of said himself, it's like, you know, it's gonna come down to a question of talent. And the other people, they may not be getting jobs because they're blacklisted, or maybe they're not getting jobs because they're just not talented enough. And I think that sort of, that uncertainty, I think it tormented Seinfeld, quite understandably.
So if you look back at The Sound of Fury, and thinking through this history, what does it make you think of when you think of the message of this film, the kind of work he was doing in the 1940s, his association with the Communist Party, and then the challenges he had, of course, with the blacklist? What should we take away from this film, which presents a very complex vision of the United States in the post-war period, kind of a classic noir, but also one that's really a kind of social problem film around the, again, flip side of the American dream? And then Enfield goes off to make this big epic later. So what is this period of his filmmaking? And what should we think about when we think about this film in retrospect?
Well, I think it's always interesting to, you know, we're looking at the film retrospectively in this context that you've just laid out like that. For Cy Enfield, at the time that he was making the film, you know, he's 36, 37 years old. He's been, you know, trying to make a go of it in Hollywood for a while. So I think part of it for him was just, oh, I've been presented with this opportunity and I want to make the most of it. I think we can very much see his political background in sort of what I was mentioning earlier, that he really wanted to have a social explanation for the, like he described, he saw the film as almost a character study between the two main characters, Lloyd Bridges and Frank Lovejoy, where we have one is a brutal psychopath and the other has been brutalized by society. And so he wants to show these two sides. And so there is his sort of Marxist socialist training. I mean, it's important that Seinfeld was very idiosyncratic too. While he did sort of wind up in that radical milieu in Hollywood, he, you know, he was also a magician. He had a lot of other worlds that he had occupied. But anyway, I think in part this was just, this is a young man with ambition. He's like, I've got my this is my shot and I want to make the best movie I can while being true to my values, which he's doing in sort of shifting the emphasis away from sort of more broader philosophizing to a more, you know, socialist vision. But at the same time, he's like, we had to step out before the conclusion of the film. We've both seen it, but that scene with the crowd, I mean, it was quite remarkable for how he filmed it. One of the things he did, he had a number of assistant directors mixing in there. It was over 300 extras. So he had people in the crowd who were using, you know, basically handheld camera to try to really create that sense of the melee. And, you know, he writes about... what he was, you know, he had assistants running around starting fights actually in various places to get the people moving. They filmed in an actual prison, which he says smelt really bad because it was by that point late May in Phoenix. It was pretty darn hot. So the whole picture was just made on his nerves and energy. He was really pouring all his ambition into this film. So I'm sort of not answering your questions by saying that I think the film we have to understand in part as about the just filmmaking ambitions of someone who is finally having a shot with a better budget to make a film that is exciting to him. But it is absolutely, of a piece with sort of what I mentioned earlier, the small cycle of very cynical, dark, political films that were made between 1948 and 1950. They're sometimes called film gris instead of film noir, because they generally have noir aesthetics, but they're combining that with this, you know, it's not just about, you know, a guy and a mall and a gun, but with, you know, darker political themes. And, you know, Cy Enfield was very much part of this group of filmmakers that were interested in presenting the darker side of the American dream.
Well, before we turn it over for questions, my last one for you is, in the theme of panic, the whole ginning up of a kind of vigilantism through newspaper and media coverage, that is obviously a big part of this film. Can you give us a sense of just what are the kind of contemporary, if there are some corollaries with this film in terms of how this really plays out then and now?
Yeah. Well, when I was first approached about doing something for this series, I was absolutely thinking of the, you know, very striking resonance with some of the most terrifying moments in recent political history, just mob violence on a public building. And obviously, we are sort of now on the other side of that, with the perpetrators having been pardoned and so on. So I, you know, of the many, many films that I could have chosen, I was interested in this one because, you know, we are dealing, we're seeing this every day. That's the role of media. Now we're, you know, it's social media that we're, you know, putting, so the emphasis is on. But again, just the dangers and perils of that, which were obviously, you know, very much front and center in people's minds in this earlier era as well. And I don't know if I want to be extrapolating further, but you know, as we started the evening off, you know, this film was made at a moment when America was entering a period of political oppression, and where, you know, freedom of speech and civil liberties were silenced and restricted, and you know, we are seeing some of that playbook again.
Thank you. Emily, will you help us with the question, please?
Would it be accurate to say that Enfield was blacklisted for reasons independent of his direction of this film?
100% accurate. He was blacklisted because in the early 1940s, he joined the Communist Party and they had records of that.
So there was nothing in particular about this film that caused him to be blacklisted?
No.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for showing the film. I've never seen it. It was really, really fascinating. I'm just curious, in the mob scene, the University of California Santa Sierra students are the ones leading the break-in into the courthouse. That seemed very intentional to do that. Why would he have the students leading the mob in like that?
Right. It's very sort of counterintuitive from a perspective of like thinking of 1960s and, you know, students would be on the opposite side of that. But as was mentioned before we saw the film, the incident that this film was based on was a true incident that happened in 1933 in Santa Clara in the Bay Area. And my understanding is that actually it was students from Santa Clara University, Jesuit University, that were at the forefront of leading this mob that broke into the jail to break out the perpetrators of the crime. So he was just adapting what had happened in real life.
I was just wondering, since this film had a lot of noir aesthetics, and you were mentioning that this whole series of films from this period had noir aesthetics, did the people that were blacklisted and had to flee to Europe also take these noir aesthetics to Europe, or did they kind of change and adapt?
Oh, I'm so happy you asked that question. It's a great question. They did generally, at least initially, continue working in the noir genre. Part of that was because they were still working on low budget productions because they were struggling, and you know, it was only the low-budget productions that were willing to take a risk on them. And film noir is a very economical shooting style because you have minimal lighting and you can sort of, you get big bang for your buck with film noir. But it was also became a bit of a bugbear for many of the exiles in that they didn't want to always be having to make these, you know, film noir crime thrillers. But that was what the European producers really wanted them to do, because American film noir was popular in Europe, and there was this idea that Hollywood does it better, so they wanted to be, they're hiring, they could hire these guys for peanuts and get a Hollywood-type product. So that was really something that by the late 1950s, you see a number of the more successful directors like Joseph Losey and Jules Dassin are really trying to break away from the noir pigeonhole by that point.
Good evening. I just wanted to get your opinion on going back to the mob scene, what you think the responsibility of media is in portraying the news accurately and, you know, leaning more towards the sensationalism and, you know, riling up people with, you know, things other than the facts and the way we see it, how it plays out in the film. And also real life.
I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I got your question entirely. So you were asking, what is the responsibility of the director to in portraying this sort of mob violence?
The media, because Gill in the movie did not do it responsibly.
And you want my personal view on that, or?
Yeah, so basically the way that it's portrayed in the movie and the way that it is portrayed, you know, now with, you know, things like Fox News and other media.
Well, you know, I agree with the with our Italian moral conscience in the film, although he does tend to put things very pedantically, that it is, you know, it's a vast responsibility how you know, how things are reported, how the narrative is shaped. I mean, Ross and I were talking about this over dinner before we came here. Just, you know, even in a way, the results of our election, you could sort of see that coming because this narrative had taken hold of, you know, Biden. And so I think the power of how we present our stories is a huge responsibility. And it's, you know, all the more complicated now because we have such an atomized, individualized way in which people get their information. So in a way, we are so far, while there are parallels with this film in terms of this, the importance of media, but our media landscape bears no resemblance to something like this, where everybody in town is reading the same, you know, newspaper, is getting the same news, and is thinking that that news is true.
I have a question. How did Lloyd Bridges view this film, you know, later on when he was looking back on his career? What did he have to say about the experience working on the film?
I have no idea. I'm sorry. But I will say that he was originally meant to be the Frank Lovejoy character. So up to this point, Lloyd Bridges had appeared in many things and was always sort of he had the blonde hair, he was the golden boy. And Enfield thought it would be interesting to mix up the casting and have Bridges be the bad guy. And I think he does that with such relish. And I think he did. And one other just Bridges-related fact, Bridges ended up being a friendly witness. He did cooperate with the committee, but it didn't seem to harm his relationship with Cy Enfield, because at some point Bridges was over in the UK and actually appears in one of Cy Enfield's early British films.
Well, I just want to thank you so much, Rebecca, for joining us,
Ross,
and helping us think through this film and this period. And
you've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.